Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to the good folks from the Cowboy Up program from Horses for Heroes, and we'll be speaking to Giovanna Paponetti about her book, Cattery, Native American Saint. I'd like now to welcome Roberta Price. She is a writer, photographer, and attorney. Her latest book is Across the Great Divide, a photo chronicle of the counterculture, published by UNM Press. And she will be speaking tonight, Wednesday, at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, we had you on talking about your memoir several years ago. You chronicled counterculture communities in the late 60s and early 70s in this part of the world, northern New Mexico, southern Colorado, and you were also part of this culture. What was it like to be both in it and a documentarian?
It made you a little schizophrenic, I guess. I used to say when I first came out here with David Perkins as a graduate student on grants to photograph communes, I was a participating observer. I worked in the kitchens, and he helped make adobe bricks, but we were outsiders. And then when we decided to move to Libre in southern Colorado in 1970, we became observing participants, or at least I did. And I guess I always felt that what we were participating in was important enough to document, or unusual enough to document. So I kept documenting it. And maybe it was my personality. I mean, I think being an observer, you're always a little bit removed by your observation. I remember when I went to high school, I did a career paper, and they asked what I wanted to be, and it was a reporter. And I actually concluded that I wouldn't be a good journalist because journalists were mostly alcoholics and spent a lot of time in bars, and I didn't like to drink. But still, I think part of it was true. I liked reporting, and I wrote poetry and was involved in writing, and I think in a sense poets are reporters too. And so I kept taking photographs of what was in front of me as much as I could. I was living a life of kind of voluntary poverty, so I couldn't afford a lot of film, and you know, there are shots I wish I'd had more film to take. There were things that I took for granted that I wish I'd taken pictures of.
Right. I mean, that's the trick. When you live in a place, you don't realize, when you're inside it, you don't realize how important it is to document it.
One man at Libre, Richard, made a beautiful goat cheese mold with a beautiful design, so the goat cheese would have a small, sort of very Buddhist kind of design in the center part of it. And for me, he and his family and my family raised goats and had made cheese and yogurt and ricotta. At any rate, it was a beautiful cheese mold, and I have no idea what happened to it, but I wish I'd taken a picture of it.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing you don't think of at the time, totally.
There's something that I think is important to talk about, even though it's been talked about before, because people who are the age that you were then, now, people who are in their early 20s, almost can't conceive of the sense of freedom and idealism and ability to really change the world or find true alternatives to the corrupt world that they came from.
Right. Well, I have a 23-year-old son, so I'm somewhat experienced. And I have to say that his generation is actually, they have their feet on the ground in a way we didn't have, and are very solid people. So I can't totally trash that generation. And I've been to a lot of...
I don't mean trashing them. I mean, they were, it's almost like the cynicism that grew out of the 60s hadn't set into you guys yet.
No. Of course not. But I feel with the Obama campaign and things like that, a lot of those young people felt a sort of hopefulness and positiveness and were invested in that. And I know of a lot of my son's friends who are doing very thoughtful, interesting things. So maybe they're more on the micro level. We were, of course, in an emotional, dramatic swing. Anybody that's seen Mad Men, even though it's a slight satire on that time and maybe not totally accurate, but there's still a lot about Mad Men that's accurate, knows that we were children that grew up with those people around us. So we made a complete dramatic swing. And also economically, we grew up in a great time of affluence. And I think, this is certainly not saying that we were any kind of spiritual leaders, but I think if you read the stories of Buddha or St. Francis, they're all very materially comfortable, and they're all sensing that there's just something missing on the spiritual plane. And I think that happened in a mass way. We were all economically comfortable and told we should continue to repeat the lives of our parents, and we all felt there was just something lacking on that plane. And now the kids today, the 23-year-olds today, have a much different economic situation to meet and deal with and struggle with. So I think of necessity, they just can't have that kind of abandon that we had at the time. And the ability to live the way we did, it may not be there in the same way. I mean, we got by on very, very little. We sort of lived off America's trash heaps. We built our house of railroad ties, reject railroad ties that were $5 a truckload. And the total cost of our house was $500. We used old windows, recycled windows. We used logs that had been cut down and left because they weren't exactly the right width, or they had a knot in them or something like that.
And you probably didn't have the building inspector coming in to see what
you'd done. No, we didn't have the building inspector. And then maybe somebody doesn't have the building inspector in some places now, but still that ability to live off America's affluence is not here now. I'm saying that also that one of the reasons I wrote Huérfano, which was a very personal memoir, and why I did this book, although there were different motivations, was to give a picture of what was happening to us and why we did what we did, as much as I could say. I think mainstream media and academia hasn't been very good to that time for lots of reasons. It was a strong anti-consumer movement. There were lots of frivolous things you could focus on, but they seemed to treat, the era occupies an historical niche somewhere between a pervasive social virus and an amusing Halloween costume.
Right.
And there's no picture of, I mean, certainly we were 21, 20, we were in our early 20s, and there were lots of stupid and frivolous things, but there were many idealistic things, and we did have the sense that you mentioned of unlimited possibilities. And I wanted people to see that and think about that, and maybe think that that was a good thing.
Well, and so many of you then went on to be attorneys, as you are, doctors, teachers, nurses, and brought in one way or another values that they learned from that time into their work.
Right. It certainly has informed many of my friends who left the Huérfano, which is where I was. And I said in my first book, we left the Huérfano, but the Huérfano didn't leave us.
Right.
And I want to talk a little bit. In the personal memoir, I just tried to, the first book, Huérfano, I tried to say, this is what happened to me. This is what made somebody who graduated from Vassar, was a graduate student, all of a sudden say, bye, I'm going to live on a mountain in Colorado on an impassable road without running water or electricity, and I'm going to build a house, even though I've never built a bookcase before.
And grow food and make cheese and right. And be utterly dependent on each other in very practical ways.
Right. It wasn't, we were, it was over 8,500 feet at the lowest part. So the idea that we could sustain ourselves was inaccurate, to say the least. But at any rate, it was a wonderful time to act on those possibilities.
We're talking to Roberta Price about her new book, which is called Across the Great Divide. It's a photo chronicle of the counterculture. Now, it's striking how many of the photographs are about the construction of your living spaces. I mean, these were great handmade achievements.
Yeah. Well, it was a time of enormous creativity, and that's what attracted us to deciding to live there. It was very exciting to think about living in a space you created with people who were being creative, musicians, artists, writers, eating off plates people made with some food or cheese or yogurt people around you made, in clothes you made, and I don't think we made our vehicles, but we, by the time they were there for a while, they were certainly not the original vehicles in any way. And as you can see in the photos, people painted on everything. We painted on the propane tanks. We made kids' toys. We painted the piano. We painted the flatbed. Everything, that kind of creativity appealed to me, and I tried to suggest certainly in the first book, that we were in the tradition of artists who go off to live inspired by artists around them and lead a creative life, except that we were doing it on a much bigger scale. We were the baby boomers. There were millions of us who had grown up in the middle class and had a certain amount of comfort and luxury and were able to make that kind of extreme choice.
What was it like for the children born in these communes, in these places? You have some pictures of children in the book.
I could never speak for the children. I say in the second book that they were some of the greatest products of that time. I think they had a sense of freedom. They could, at a very early age, walk out the door, and my friend's son, when he was two or three, could walk up the ridge to my house all by himself and knock on the door and sit with me and have a cookie and milk and talk to me and then just say, well, goodbye now. And I wouldn't have to think, well, what you know.
Is he going to be sad?
And, you know, they had that sense of everyone around was friendly, and that expansiveness when they were growing up. And there have been, you know, memoirs by children of the communes that I think give a much better, certainly some of their experiences were challenging and difficult, and some of them didn't have easy childhoods. But the ones I know from the time they were born there are doing pretty interesting and exciting things, and they're wonderful people.
What are some of your fondest memories of that time?
That's a tough one. I guess you'll have to look at my pictures. I think the...
Do they, I guess, in some ways, they really show what you were fondest of, because you took...
Yes, much of the time. I think living in that landscape, for somebody who grew up in suburban or rural New York, outside of the city, but still spending time in New York City, who attended... you know, went to school in Poughkeepsie, New York, who was in graduate school in Buffalo, New York. The first time I saw the West and thought about, this is where I want to live, I mean, certainly that's, I'm still living here, in fact. that's certainly one of my best memories. And also the memories of being able to see so many creative, interesting people and have the time to go down in the winter time after you made sure you had enough wood and, you know, had taken care of all the pragmatic things. Especially in the winter, you could come down and have a cup of coffee and sit around the fire or the potbelly and talk to people about the book they were reading or the book they were writing or look at the painting they were doing. And that kind of that kind of leisure isn't quite so present in my life right now.
You know, it's, as you say, people like to trivialize that whole time, the people in it, the achievements that they had. I mean, when you look at the pictures in this book, and they were building sort of Buckminster Fuller-like geodesic domes with their hands and like a book.
Right.
You know, it was incredible the things they did. And at the same time, it's true that it wasn't sustainable. Why was it not? Why did they not last more than, say, a decade or so?
Well, I think I'm not a scholar at that time, so I can't give you a scholarly answer. When people ask me at Book Events, why did you fail? I don't think we failed. As you mentioned, the Red Rockers, one community built the largest amateur-built dome ever built. At least they claim that. Nobody's contradicted them. And they were just a group of kids from Beverly Hills, and actually the core group was, and then there were other people. But we did all these things that we set out to do. And I think when you're 20, you think in terms of extremes. And certainly when I came to the Valley, I thought, okay, this is where I'm going to die. This is where I want to be. This is what I'll be doing. But a lot of people think that in their 20s about many different things, and then they change and grow and become more interested. And so I don't think that particular experiment was a failure in any way, and perhaps that was the time, the amount of time they were supposed to last in that way. Although Libre, the place I lived, is still going on in a somewhat different form, but it's still in existence. It just had its 40th birthday. I went up for the 40th birthday party a couple of years ago.
Llama Foundation is still doing its thing.
And so, and as I haven't made a study of this, but as I have been going around, people come up to me and say, wait, do you know about that group of that community that's living on the other side of the mountain, and they have a band that goes to Las Vegas every couple of weeks and makes a lot of money and comes back to support the community, and they're all, and I think I heard this from a dental assistant in Albuquerque, and I didn't know about it. So there's experiments with co-housing. I met someone at dinner at Jennifer James the other night who said she was living in Fort Collins at a co-housing community, and they're certainly, those ideas are still maybe moving under the radar in a way. And certainly, as I said before, what we did then informed the rest of our lives to a great extent.
Your photo archive is now at the Beinecke Rare Books Library at Yale University. Have scholars been using it? What do you hope?
It's not there yet.
Okay, so it's on its way.
George Miles, the curator of Western America, said, oh, I don't care if I get it when you're dead, which was sort of somewhat shocking to me. But what appealed to me about the Beinecke is they have a very good utopian collection. They have a women photographer collection, and they have a wonderful Western Americana collection. So there'll be scholars who are looking at those photos from different directions. And also the Beinecke has promised to digitize all of the photographs and put them online. So they'll be available to scholars, but they'll also be available to the people in the pictures. And
nice.
I have never been, I just don't have the time and the money to send people copies and pictures of them. So I'm very happy with that. And actually, that is what inspired my doing the second book. I really felt I'd said everything I wanted to say in the first book. I really felt I'd given it my best shot and I'd done it. But after George Miles flew out here and made the offer for the photographs, I thought, well, I mean, it took me, I'm an intellectual property attorney, but it still took me around 6 months to realize, well, I have the copyright for my life, but if I want to do shows or a book, it's going to be very hard if the negatives and slides are back in New Haven, no matter how supportive the Beinecke is. So it was like sort of duh. And so I decided to see if there was interest in shows and a book. And there was. So I'm doing four shows across the country of about 45 images, which I'm very happy about because they're larger, of course, than they are in the book. And there are all sorts of details you can notice in that large format. I mean, they're not too large because they're 35-millimeter film. And UNM Press was interested in doing a book. So it was a very pragmatic decision to do this book. It was sort of like, well, I guess I better, because if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. And half the time I thought, well, this is redundant. Why am I doing this? And you always question yourself, I think, when you're working on any book. But people have told me it's different in a way. It's not my personal story. And I was very careful to point out in the preface of this book, if you want to read about what it was like for me, you should read this other book. And I think of the two books as really as a set. I really feel like they both sort of give a picture of the time in a way, and a complete, more complete picture than just the one book did.
Roberta Price is the author and photographer of the book Across the Great Divide, a photo chronicle of the counterculture, published by UNM Press. And once again, she'll be speaking tonight, Wednesday, at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome Rick Iannucci, Stuart Angel, and Nancy DeSantis. They are from Horses for Heroes, which is a really interesting program that's happening right here south of Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Good morning.
So this is a program where you are basically using horses and riding and doing the work of ranching as a therapeutic process, particularly for veterans, of whom you, Stuart, are one, returning with post-traumatic stress or other kinds of stress.
That's correct. We worked, and we've been on your show before, and thank you. We've had some great response from that. We work with combat wounded veterans, mostly Operation Iraqi Freedom or Enduring Freedom from Afghanistan, either with combat injuries, physical injuries, or post-traumatic stress disorders.
And
that we now call combat trauma.
Yeah, combat trauma, better word, sort of more direct kind of descriptive word, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Than the
absolutely
psycho jargon.
Absolutely.
Well, either way, there's a reintegration process that happens as we matriculate from military to civilian life. And there's some real interesting transitions that we all go through, whether it's from military to civilian or from working to retirement. We still go through some of the same issues, and it's nice to have something to lean back on and someone to show us the way once in a while.
What was it like for you, Stuart, coming back and then getting involved with the ranch and the horses?
Well, like I said, there was definitely a learning curve in the reintegration process. I met Rick about 6 months ago, and that was just by serendipity. We ran into each other here in Santa Fe, and really the rest is history. I was invited to come to the program. I was looking at it as an opportunity to learn about the program and possibly write about it. But the more things I find myself doing, well, we're very dynamic, and there's always something else that we can do, and there's always another facet of what we can do to be of service to others and be of service to veterans and to each other, first and foremost.
What Stuart's saying is that once we bring someone into the Cowboy Up program, which what we call the program, Horses for Heroes New Mexico Incorporated is the parent organization, our 501c3 nonprofit. But the Cowboy Up program, once we operate under special forces principles, and I'm a former Green Beret, so we operate on see one, do one, and teach one. And almost from day one, when the guys and gals come into the program, and we have females as well, they get started, and whatever it is that they've learned, we turn around and have them assist us the next time teaching someone else. So we're like a giant family. Once they're into the program, they'll show up, and as evidenced by last week, we had six veterans come up from the clinic, inpatient from the STAR and the PTSD program at the VA hospital. And I didn't even have to ask the other fellas, and they just showed up to help out. So we had about six veterans that are currently in the program at different stages just show up to help their brothers that are coming in from the VA inpatient to get horseback. They helped them groom. They helped them get. So wherever they were, they just stood up to that level. You know, they rose to that level to help groom or to help saddle or to help ride. In Stewart's case, he's been with us for over a half a year now. And he's been able to, he's great ground walking with the fellas and getting him a little bit more straight in the saddle and balanced, a little bit more thorough in their handling of the reins and all the things that he's gone through. So there's nothing better to learn something as to have to turn around and teach it.
Right. Exactly.
The challenges are certainly there, Rick, and thank you for that. Every time I come out there, I'm certainly challenged, and it's something new every day. Every time I attend a training or a riding program, I'm always learning something new and saddled with new challenges.
What is it about, do you think, Nancy, getting on a horse, riding, being outdoors, that is specifically therapeutic for people coming back with combat trauma?
I would say that it is therapeutic because when you are in the world of the horse, you have to be there at that moment with the horse. So you can't be thinking about what am I going to be buying tomorrow when I'm in town or whatever. You can't think about that because you're in the moment with the horse. And they only operate on the present moment. So somebody with PTSD will come in, and they have different anxiety levels. So, and they have sometimes, many times, trouble focusing. So being on the horse is a meditative type thing. You kind of enter this Zen space, and the horse helps you there because you have to be present.
And, you know, it's in a way, it's interesting to me. It's like enforced meditation, because I mean, if you're sitting on a cushion meditating, you're not going to get thrown off.
Exactly. And that's why I myself really enjoy it, because it is the only time I can meditate, so it forces me to be in there. But it's not the type of forcing, you know, that any other discipline, let's say,
right,
would
what
be.
What you're saying is very true, because combat warriors are used to consequential actions. For everything that they do, you go out on a combat patrol, it's very there's consequences to it. If you do this, something happens. There's a certain physics to it. And we use what you're saying as an analogy for our guys and gals and say, hey, you're on this horse, there are consequences to everything you do. If you press your left leg in, there is a certain dynamic that happens, or your right leg, or if you lift your reins up, or you sit back on your pockets, you know, everything has its consequences. For instance, if we're moving cattle, if you get ahead of those cows, or your horse starts pitching a little bit, or something like that. So it's a very similar experience as combat, and one of the hallmarks of our organization is that we bring we give everyone a new mission, as you and I talked about before. And I also wanted to let you know too, since we've spoken, we have our first program graduate we're proud to announce. And
how do you graduate?
There's about 12 objectives that Nance and I developed, and when they get through about the 12 objectives, and the final one being teach a full lesson with supervision, we award them their purple wild rag, and that's basically that's the cowboy yeah. way, the cowboy scarf, and that's basically cooperation with our affiliation and our partnership with the Military Order of the Purple Heart in New Mexico. So they get the purple wild rag, and they're off to do some cattle work with us and things like that. Of course, they've already done stuff in the arena.
So it's not like they have, once they graduate, they don't have to leave.
No,
there's no leaving.
Because I would think you'd never want to graduate.
Leave. Actually, the guys don't leave. In fact, we had 16 of these guys for Thanksgiving dinner.
And they were tasty.
but basically, they're focusing on a new mission, and the new mission, because they're all mission-oriented folks, And that is one thing that we found that they're lacking when they come back. They're lacking that, and the second part of that that goes hand in hand is the camaraderie that you get, that warrior trust bond. And we supply that again.
And you have that in the context of a ranch.
We have that in context of that, and with all the veterans showing up to help each other, that bond is there. And, like, we don't even have to, as I said before, don't even have to ask anybody to show up. These guys that are in the program just show up to help each other out.
So this is a nonprofit. You're having a fundraiser on Thursday, the 9th of December, at Vanessi's, which is such a wonderful place. They do so much great for the community. It's cocktails at 5, and there's speakers at 5:30, and dinner at 6 o'clock in the evening, Thursday, the 9th of December.
Yeah, we're going to have December 9th, Thursday night. We're going to have Ricardo Cate, is a Marine veteran from the Kiowa Pueblo, formerly known as Santo Domingo.
And he does that great comic strip in the paper called Without Reservations.
Absolutely.
I love that.
He's a side-splitting guy. He's actually a stand-up comedian as well.
So he'll be there.
He'll be there, and he's going to kick off the program that evening. He's become a very good friend of ours. And the second he found out we were having the dinner, the fundraiser, and which is our first ever, we've got so many. The exponential growth in this program has been so great that we really have to do something to keep it going. But anyway, Ricardo found out about it and called and said, hey, I'm there. And that's all it took. And so he's actually on KSFR, too. He's got some programs in the evening.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So you have been able to basically gather the funding together that you need to keep this program going and make it available to as many veterans as want to be in it?
Actually, I still fund this out of my pension.
No way.
I do. And that's why we're having our first, because we're getting three new horses from the Express UU Bar Ranch up in Cimarron. They are one of our program partners. They're also one of our program partners through our affiliation with the New Mexico Cattle Growers Association. So we'll be having, so we've got to feed them, and they literally will, quote unquote, eat you out of house and home. So because of the growth in the program, we definitely had to do something to try to, as you know, hay is quite expensive, and we have to hay all year long here in Santa Fe.
Now, when you have veterans who have gone through this program, and I guess it is really effective, and they become, I mean, Stuart, you can speak to this as much as anybody. You become calmer through doing it. You become less anxious through doing it.
Well, I've certainly become more social. There was a time where I was actually exhibiting some antisocial and, frankly, dangerous behaviors. And part of what I've benefited in this program is from the constant personal contact and the constant always having a mission. Rick's always giving me something to do, whether it's talking on the radio or feeding horses or unloading giant semi-load trailers full of hay. Well, I got a mission, and I got to keep those behaviors in check, and I got to keep myself in check, and I got to be ready to go. And I appreciate that opportunity. The more I make myself available, the more opportunities come my way, and it's working for us. So
it's a self-sustainable program.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing thing. It's such a great idea. I'm surprised. I would think there are or should be programs like this all over the country.
There are horse therapy programs around the country, but nobody doing what we're doing.
In fact,
we're going to be featured in this month's New Mexico Stockman magazine coming up, and we're also going to be featured in Working Ranch magazine, Tim O'Byrne's magazine this month. So they were... That's what we thought, that there'd probably be somebody else doing what we're doing, but to tie the horse therapy, wellness, and the ranch skills / vocational rehab parts all together, there wasn't anybody doing that. So.
And so then you are equipped with skills you didn't have before.
Absolutely. I did the vocational rehab program through the Veterans Administration, and I guess I've learned in 6 months what... I didn't do in 8 years of getting a college degree. So it's been real good for me as far as the socialization and, you know, keeping some of my own behaviors in check and staying busy and staying positive at all times has really had an effect in me and my personal life and my family life and also my professional life. Thanks, Rick. Nancy.
Yeah. Now, do you find that folks who have been, perhaps, as some returning vets are, dangerous to themselves and dangerous to others, are truly healing? Like those parts become less dangerous, you can trust yourself more?
Absolutely.
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 Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For lack of a better word, I'm domesticated again.
Yeah.
Not such a wild man.
One of the things that we found is that the camaraderie and the way that everyone comes into the program, and for lack of a better description, the love that's shared amongst each other in this program, and the ranching community that's also embraced this program, basically dilutes all those other feelings that some of these guys have had in the past, the disconnection and those type of things. There's a real connection because the ranching community and what we do in this program is basically the overlay, integrity, loyalty, all those, and the cowboy ethic and the cowboy code is an overlay over top of what the warrior ethos was.
It's interesting that you use the word dilute. There are so many metaphors for thinking about the mind and thinking about healing, mm-hmm. and the idea that you can just sort of dissolve some of the real toxic stuff.
Yeah, because we found that the PTSD, those experiences never go away. So what we're trying to do is just refocus and rechannel them, and dilute the bad portions and the toxic thoughts, like in that respect.
The program is called Cowboy Up. It's a program of Horses for Heroes, which can be found on the web at horsesforheroes.org. And we've been talking to Rick Iannucci, Stuart Angel, and Nancy DeSantis. The event, once again, Thursday, December 9th at 5 o'clock in the evening. Going forward through the evening, the wonderful guest speaker
is Ricardo Cate.
Also, music by the Bus Tapes.
Yeah, the Bus Tapes are coming in. They're going to do some music for us. They've been great for us. And people can still buy their tickets online. They can either go through us, and we'll hold the tickets because time may be short. And we are selling out pretty quick. They can buy their tickets online, or they can call us. You can call me at 505-670-2059 or go on www.horsesforheroes.org, and they can purchase tickets online. We'll have them at the door for them.
Rick, Stuart, and Nancy, thanks for being with us, and thanks for the great work you do.
And thank you for coming out and seeing us.
I have, in fact, done that, and even had some contact with those beautiful horses.
And they miss you.
Thank
you. All right,
you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Giovanna Paponetti. She is the author and illustrator of Cattery, Native American Saint. And she will be speaking and signing her book and selling prints on Saturday, this coming Saturday, December 4th from 11 to 1 at the Clearlight Book Gallery at 851 San Mateo here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte, and I'm very grateful that you are having me on your program. And I say a big hello to all your listeners.
Oh, thanks. Who was Cattery? It's funny to hear the term Native American saint.
Well, yes, Cattery was born in New York State near Albany, present-day Albany, New York. And this was a period of time when the Jesuit priests were converting Native Americans to Catholicism. And her mother, and she was born, by the way, in 1656. And she was a Mohawk woman, part of the Iroquois Nation. Her mother kidnapped Algonquin from a mission in Canada and fell in love, or her father was a Mohawk chief who fell in love with her. And so they got married, and when Cattery was four, her parents and baby brother died of smallpox. And so Cattery was raised by her aunt and uncle, who then became her guardians, and her uncle then became the chief. Well, after a period of time, the black robes, or the Jesuit priests, were invited to come back into the longhouses. They had been banned for quite a while when the Iroquois was at war with the French. And when they came back, her uncle, being the chief, had to invite the black robes back to his longhouse. And so Kateri became very curious about them. And my feeling is that she must have reminisced about her mother. Her mother, being a Catholic, must have told her some things about the Catholic religion. And Kateri, since she had the smallpox, she was heavily scarred and her eyesight was impaired. So she couldn't play with the other children. She became quite introverted. But this interested her. And the more she came to know the Black Robes and their teachings of the Catholic religion, the more she became interested. So she decided to be baptized and learn more about it. Well, her passion was so strong that her tribe was very threatened by this. They were not happy with the idea of their people becoming Catholics, because then they would leave the nation, the tribal nation, and go to a Christian mission in Canada. And because they depended so heavily upon their members in the longhouse to survive, it was very threatening for them to lose their members for Christianity. So when Kateri became so passionate about Catholicism, she was threatened by other members of her tribe, and the Jesuit priests were so scared that they took her one night by canoe to this mission in Canada, where she thrived and taught others. And she also did penances on herself, with which the priests were not happy about. And she ended up dying at a very young age because of the flagellation she inflicted upon herself. 15 minutes after her death, her scars from the smallpox disappeared. And this is all documented in the Jesuit Relations. I did a considerable amount of research before I embarked on this project. And so that was the first miracle. The second miracle occurred when she appeared to a priest and gave him a message of a church crumbling and a Native American being burned at the stake. Well, these two things came true, and so the priest was given credibility that he had actually seen her. Another visitation by her a short while afterwards was that the priest, Father Shoshatir, should do a painting of Kateri, which he did a year later, and he would place the painting or drawing on the forehead of sick people, and they would be healed. So many more miracles are attributed to Kateri. And I've heard of present-day miracles being attributed to her as well. And at the present moment, the Pope is considering two present-day healings that are attributed to Kateri, Kateri's intercession. And once this is approved, Kateri will become a saint. She's gone through different stages of sainthood, and the last one now is she's waiting to be canonized.
When those kinds of stories come down about scars going away or magical healings take place, they have a kind of mythological interest. In your view, are any of them in any way true?
Oh, I totally believe it. You know, I with all the reference that I've done, the research, as I mentioned to you, these were all completely documented by the Jesuit priest who journaled her life and their everyday living. And I do. I really believe it.
So how did you come across her story?
Well, let's see. Back in 1991, I was visiting New Mexico in Taos from the East Coast, where I lived in Connecticut. And I was introduced to a woman at Taos Pueblo. Her name was Tonita Lujan. And when I walked into her house and I saw all these pictures of a beautiful Indian woman with crosses, and I asked her about it, and she told me Kateri's life story. And she was very passionate about it, and she told me that she attended annual conferences that were held for Kateri to promote her canonization. And it was then that I learned that there was a very large organization out of Montana with 500,000 members, mostly Native American, who are supporting this canonization for Kateri to become the first Native American saint. And then back in 2005, 5 years ago, I was introduced to Father Terry Brennan at the Okeewingee St. John the Baptist Church. And when I was leaving, I handed him my business card, which had one of my Native American paintings on it. And he said, "Did you do this?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, this is the exact style I'm looking for, very classical, to do this project for members of his Kateri Tikawitha Circle at Okeewingi Church." And so I agreed to do this, having already known a bit about her from my friend Tonita Lujan. And so that's how it all started. And the first thing I said to him was, "Well, if you want me to do this, I want authentic Mohawk models for my paintings." So we planned a trip to the Kahnawake Reservation in Canada near present-day Montreal. And this is where Kateri is buried, in St. Francis Xavier Church on the reservation. And so six Pueblo ladies, the priest and I, journeyed there and got permission to photograph members of the tribe. And it's been a wonderful experience.
Giovanna Paponetti is author and illustrator of Kateri, Native American Saint. It's a book, I guess you would you call it a children's book? It's kind of...
Well, I think I would say, no, not a children's book. I would say for children from 12 years old and up to adults. Yeah, it's for everyone. My paintings are very detailed descriptions of her life story and the stories that go accompany the paintings. So it's for everyone.
Kateri, Native American Saint, and once again, author Giovanna Paponetti will be speaking and signing her book and also selling prints on Saturday, this Saturday, the 4th of December, from 11 to 1 at the Clearlight Book Gallery at 851 San Mateo. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, Mary Charlotte, may I just mention also that I recently received a letter from Pope Benedict the 16th thanking me for a copy of the book that I sent to him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And that was very exciting.
Now, are you Italian Catholic?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so that there's sort of a Catholic connection for you?
Right. Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Okay. Thank you very, very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.